You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today is part 5 in our series on the Burke and Wills Expedition. A few comments to start. I'm going to start putting additional reading resources on the website for each episode. In the past, I've only done this at the end of a series, but I've had some requests to do them earlier, so that's what I'll do. Resources generally include a few books on the subject matter and some links to helpful websites. You can find this list of resources on explorerspodcast.com. I will put a link to the site in the show notes. Item number 2. As I was writing this last episode, I was struck by the fact that we are already on part 5 of the series. You might be wondering why this series is taking so long. After all, the Burke and Wills expedition is not that well known of a subject. Well, there are a couple of reasons for this. First, we have a large amount of original source material for Burke and Wills. Some of the participants wrote books, everyone involved wrote letters and journals, and we have sources from the day such as newspaper articles, which is not always the case in our show. And second, the Burke and Wills expedition splits up several times, and all the various elements play a part in our story. The events in Melbourne and Menindee and Cooper's Creek and now in the outback of Australia are all intertwined. Thus, we have a lot of threads that we have to keep track of. And finally, this is just a really fascinating tale. So much stuff happens, good and bad, and that just means that we have a lot to discuss. Anyhow, with that said, let us move on to part 5 in the series. So, last time we left Burke and Wills as they departed Cooper's Creek. Burke left a contingent of men at the camp there under William Brough, and another contingent of men were at Menindee under the command of William Wright. We will visit with each of these today, but the bulk of our time will be spent with Burke and Wills. However, with that said, let's start our show with an update on Burke's rival from South Australia, John McDougall Stewart. As we have discussed in the past, John McDougall Stewart had tried to cross Australia in 1860. He had reached the center of the continent, but had been forced back by hostile natives. Well, Stewart was going to try it again. He would depart from his inland base at Chambers Creek on January 1, 1861, with a dozen men, 49 horses, and supplies for 30 weeks. Stewart was a formidable explorer. He hired quality men, whom he trusted and relied on. He had strict rules of behavior and established a routine that helped the men thrive in a difficult situation. Also, Stewart never divided his party, and, for the most part, respected the native Aboriginal peoples. However, Stewart had some issues ahead of him. The first was his health. His life as an explorer was taking a toll on him. He had suffered from scurvy on his last expedition and had never fully recovered from its debilitating effects. Also, his eyes were failing due to life in the harsh outdoors and taking sun sightings. This was not an uncommon thing for desert explorers, not to mention mariners, who would go blind from the glare of the sun reflecting off the ocean all of their lives. Christopher Columbus's eyes were so bad in the last years of his life that he would only come out at night. And the second issue was that Stewart was leaving at a dangerous time of year, the summer. As we will see with Robert Burke and the VEE, the summer months offer a challenge that can be deadly. No matter, the gauntlet had been thrown down. Stewart, representing South Australia, was hot on the heels of Burke, who carried the hopes of Victoria on his back. Burke had known that Stewart was going to make another effort to reach the north coast, and it was a major reason he had departed right before summer, instead of waiting for the cooler winter months. So that is our update on John McDougall Stewart. Let us now go to Cooper's Creek and touch base with William Brough. At the VEE's base at Cooper's Creek, William Braw and the other three men were basically not trying to go crazy. They knew that they would have to survive 3 to 4 months at the supply depot. This was the hottest time of the year, but at least the creek provided a reliable source of water. Braw first built a stockade, which measured 18 by 20 feet. The stockade was constructed around two large coolabah trees, which provided the men with ample shade, and served as the center of life in the camp. The men quickly fell into a routine. In the mornings, William Patton, the blacksmith, would lead the horses to graze, often going as far as 10 miles away to find suitable fodder. Dos Mohammed would do the same with the camels. Braw or McDonough would collect firewood, but someone always remained at the stockade to guard the supplies. The reason was that the local Aboriginal people liked to sneak away with the cool stuff that the expedition possessed. This petty pilfering drove the men crazy. They'd hang a shirt on a tree to dry and turn around to find it gone. One day, 6 camel bags were stolen. The locals, by the way, came to the camp on occasion, but mostly they were chased off. The stealing of items became such an issue that on December 30th, Braw would fire his revolver over the heads of some men creeping around the camp. The natives would respond by coming to the stockade in a large group. They carried spears and boomerangs, and their faces and bodies were painted. Braw would answer the implied threat by drawing a circle around the camp and indicating to the men that if they crossed the line, he would fire. The Aboriginal people were not stupid. They had seen what the white men's weapons could do. They would refrain from harassing Braw and his men, but they were not happy. Remember, it was Aboriginal custom for visitors to move on after staying a short time in the territory of another tribe. So to the natives, the white men were being rude and challenging by setting up a permanent home around a prime waterhole. The major issue here was the inability to communicate. If Braw had had a translator, he could have diffused these situations and even used the knowledge of the Aboriginal people to help survive the time at Cooper's Creek. Instead, it would be a time marked by paranoia and fear rather than cooperation. Now, the other thing I want to mention about Braw and the men at the supply depot was the fact that they were not particularly healthy. This had come from eating a diet lacking in vitamins and nutrients for months and months. Illnesses such as scurvy and beriberi were common due to the lack of specific vitamins, and both could be deadly. Much of this could have been alleviated if the men had hunted and fished more often. Fresh meat will provide a man enough of the vitamins needed to stay healthy, at least for a few months. Unfortunately, Burke had abandoned much of the fishing gear back at Menindee, and if Braw had paid attention to the Aboriginal people, he would have seen how they used nets to go fishing. In the end, most of what the men ate was from the provisions they had brought from Melbourne, and the results of that diet would soon rear their ugly head, when William Patton would begin to complain about sore legs and gums, both early indications that scurvy was taking hold in the ranks of the men. So that is it for the men at Cooper's Creek. The heat, isolation, and poor diet will gradually chip away at the mental and physical well-being of Braw and his comrades. Their only hope was that William Wright would soon arrive, bringing much-needed relief and support. And with that, it is time to transition our story over to Mr. William Wright. It was early January 1861. William Wright had his commission and financing. Now, after months of waiting, he would finally begin to prepare to transport all the supplies from the VEE's camp at Menindee to Cooper's Creek. I cannot stress how important this was. What Burke had brought to Cooper's Creek back in October was not enough to sustain those men for more than a few months. Wright began by purchasing 10 horses, at inflated prices, as the locals around Menindee knew how desperate the expedition was to acquire said animals. He would also have to buy saddles and provisions. One problem here. The horses Wright purchased were not broken in, meaning that they were not trained to carry a rider, or saddle, or pack. Thus, the men of the VEE would have to do that themselves, and that would take time. Wright would not depart the camp at Menindee until January 26th, over 3 months since leaving Burke at the Toroto Swamp, and pledging to get the men and supplies up to Cooper's Creek as quickly as possible. This was not what Burke had in mind. One of the members of the expedition, Alexander McPherson, would not accompany the men north, as he was still recovering from being stranded in the desert with Trooper Miles Lyons the previous month. That would leave Wright with Dr. Herman Beckler, Ludwig Becker, William Hodgkinson, and Belloc, the latter a sepoy. To supplement his numbers, Wright hired 3 local men, as well as Dick, the Aboriginal man who had served as a guide and translator in the past. Just a month earlier, Dick had traveled on foot almost 200 miles from the Toroto Swamp to Menindee, a feat that would save the lives of McPherson and Lyons. I want to note that Herman Beckler had, technically, resigned from the party, but here he was pushing north with Wright and the others. The relief expedition had 13 horses and 10 camels. Wright estimated that it would take at least a month to get to Cooper's Creek. However, very early, it became apparent that it would take much, much longer. The first issue was that the horses were not fully broken in, and they would frequently throw their loads and run off. On the very first day, some of the horses scattered, and it would take 2 days to find them all. The expedition would travel only 6 miles, total, in the first 3 days. And the other big issue was the heat. It was the middle of summer, and the men of the expedition quickly realized how brutally hot it was. One morning, at 10 a.m., the temperature was already 104 degrees. The water holes, so plentiful a few months ago, were gone, or transformed into undrinkable sludge. Everything was parched. Traveling at this time of year was, honestly, a foolish thing to do. But Wright and the men knew that they had to risk it. The survival of those at Cooper's Creek depended on them. So, on the third day, with things not looking so rosy, the Aboriginal guide, Dick, had breakfast, borrowed a clean shirt, and decided to make himself scarce. And with that, Wright had just lost his best guide, as well as interpreter. This was a big blow. Communications with the locals was a critical tool for survival. One of the new men, John Smith, had an Aboriginal mother and a white father, and he knew a little of the local language, but he was limited compared to Dick. So the expedition pushed north. It would become very clear that water was going to be the main issue. A horse needs at least 10 gallons of water a day, but they were lucky to get 3 or 4. The horses would quickly lose the sheen on their coats, and their eyes would sink in. They struggled to lift their heads and even eat. They were so desperate for water that, even though they were hobbled, they would wander off at night in search of it. The camels were much better off. Wright would use the tactic of sending the camels forward to the water holes and having them bring back water for the horses. It was a slow and exhausting system. Things got so bad, Wright believed the horses were going to die. In the end, Wright struggled to keep the men in a routine and maintain discipline. Thus, the trek north was painfully slow. The expedition would reach Mutawicha in early February. Mutawicha is a mountainous plateau that was a life-saving oasis for the VEE. Here, there was plenty of food and water. The expedition would stay at Mutawicha for 5 days, recuperating. It would do wonders for everyone, especially the horses. Wright and the relief column would depart on February 7th, and within a couple of days, water was again nowhere to be found. They would finally reach the Torowota Swamp on February 12th. It had taken 18 days to get there, compared to just 10 back in October. Again, the men and animals were exhausted, but now they had food and water, at least for a while. So the Torowota Swamp is where we will leave William Wright and the relief expedition for today. They were, roughly, halfway to Cooper's Creek. But what lay ahead was what scared Wright the most. He had never been beyond the Torowota Swamp, none of the men had, and his interpreter, Dick, was not there to try and find a guide from amongst the natives. More than anything, William Wright was terrified of getting lost in the blazing summer heat. It was a heat that would turn the desert into a furnace and literally suck the water out of the land. He knew that getting lost would mean the deaths of all of them. But Wright also knew that he needed to reach Cooper's Creek if Robert Burke and the rest of the VEE were to survive. He had promised Burke that he would do it, and he intended to keep that promise. And with that, let us pivot our story to the star of our series, Mr. Robert O'Hara Burke.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Robert Burke departed from Cooper's Creek on December 16, 1860. With him were William Wills, John King, and Charlie Gray, plus 6 camels and 1 horse, and provisions for 90 days. We've talked quite a bit about Burke and Wills, but let's take a look at King and Gray, as they are important to the rest of our tale. John King was an Irishman. He was a short, quiet man, who had turned 22 just a few days before departing for the North Coast. He had joined the British Army, serving in India at the height of the Indian Mutiny in 1857. It had been a brutal, bloody rebellion, and King would have seen some terrible things. He would become sick while in India, with fever-like symptoms, likely early indications of tuberculosis. He spent over a year recuperating from his illness when, in 1859, he met George Landells, who was there to buy camels for the VEE. Landells was impressed by King's quiet, stoic demeanor and his ability to speak the language of the sepoys. King was able to buy a discharge from the army and accompany Landells to Australia. King was seen as a calm, sensible young man with a strong sense of duty. Everyone liked him because he worked hard and caused minimal drama. In the dispute between Landells and Burke, he never took sides. King was important to the golf party as he could handle the camels. Our other man was Charles Gray, or Charlie, as he was known to everyone. Gray was a Scotsman in his mid-40s. A former sailor, he had jumped ship years earlier to work in the Australian goldfields. Gray was a big bear of a man who was known as a hard worker and a sort of jack-of-all-trades guy. He enjoyed drinking, maybe a little too much at times, but he was well-liked by everyone. So Burke and his three men, plus the camels and horse, headed down Cooper's Creek for 3 days before following side creeks to the north. These early days were easy going for the VEE. The weather was good, water plentiful, and the heat had not overtaken the region just yet. Burke noted that the area would make for good sheep grazing country. This smaller party was a big positive for Robert Burke. There was less chaos and fewer things to throw the men off their routine. And routine was a good thing for everyone, especially Burke, who, as we have seen, was not at his best when things went sideways. Typically, the men of the expedition would wake around sunrise, between 4 and 5 in the morning. The first thing they would do was turn their boots upside down to make sure that no scorpions had crawled in. Gray would take care of packing up the camp. There were no tents, so this was a relatively quick process. John King would deal with the camels, including loading them. This was a bit tricky, as it was essential to evenly distribute the loads on the animals, otherwise they could tip over. The camels, by the way, could carry around 120 to 150 pounds for 30 or more miles in a day. They could carry lots more, but the distance they covered would be less. This had always been a sticking point between Burke and George Landells, the former camel master. Once the camels and the horse were ready, the expedition would get going, seeking to cover as much ground as possible while the heat was not so intense. All of the men would ride camels, with Burke usually in the lead, followed by Wills. Gray would follow the officers, leading Billy the horse, and King would bring up the rear, leading the pack camels. Burke would make all the final decisions as to where the expedition was going, but it was Wills who kept them on course. On a typical day, the expedition would stop, in a shady spot if possible, after a few hours for breakfast, which usually consisted of salted meat, tea, and damper, the latter a traditional Australian soda bread, which was made the night before. These breaks were not long, as the men and the animals found it difficult to get going once they had stopped. The camels in particular could be stubborn, and were famously loud and ornery when they didn't want to work. The VEE would typically travel anywhere from 10 to 13 hours in a day. When evening approached, a camp would be selected. Ideally, the location would provide access to water, firewood, shade, and food for the animals. Camels, by the way, will eat just about anything, but they were particularly fond of a common herb named parakeelia. The camels would usually be hobbled at night to prevent them from straying too far, or bolting, as William Wills had experienced. Hobbling means to use a device to limit the motion of the animal, such as tethering its legs together. Setting up the camp, just like breaking it down, would not take long. It was mostly done by King and Gray. Also, every night, King would carve into a tree the letter B, followed by a camp number, his way of blazing their trail. The B was for Burke, and the camp number was in Roman numerals. Some of these blaze marks still exist to this day, although many have been hacked away by souvenir hunters over the years, and others are fake. In the evening, a meal would be prepared, usually by Gray. Dinner consisted of salted beef, rice, bread, tea, and sugar. Also, the damper bread would be baked for the next day's journey. The officers would write in their journals, although Burke's notations are quite sparse. Wills, on the other hand, often spent upwards of 1 to 2 hours recording his observations and experiences of the day. Also, Wills would stay up late into the night and move away from the light of the camp and take astronomical observations for several hours. A campfire was kept burning as long as possible during the night to fend off mosquitoes, and there was no guard posted, as Burke did not fear the Aboriginal people or any wild animals. And speaking of the Aboriginal peoples, the VEE would encounter the locals pretty much whenever they were near a water source. Many of these natives had never seen a white man, but for the most part, they were eager to meet the strange newcomers. They would frequently bring gifts of fish for Burke and his men, who gave them beads and matches in return. One tribe offered Burke some women, an offer that was quickly rejected. Burke's policy was to avoid contact with the Aboriginal peoples unless necessary. He did not want any distractions, and with such a small group, he feared getting into a fight. The best weapon against the natives were the camels. The Aboriginal peoples had never seen such creatures, and their great size and bellowing frightened most everyone who encountered them. Also, it did not hurt that the VEE moved on each night, never overstaying their welcome in any single place. Now, as the expedition neared the Stony Desert, Burke did try and convince the Aboriginal people to guide the expedition across it, but he would have no luck. Burke and Wills and the men would be on their own. And that brings us to the Stony Desert, or the Sturt Stony Desert, as it is called today. Most of the desert is covered in tightly packed sandstones, almost like pavement. The Stony Desert had nearly killed Charles Sturt 15 years earlier. The explorer had returned to Adelaide almost dead from scurvy, his legs and gums black, and his body racked in pain. Burke had gone northwest from Cooper's Creek, and on December 22nd, reached the edge of the desert, heading into it the next day. So, crossing the Stony Desert was Burke's first major challenge. And the result? Well, not bad. Yes, it was hot and dusty, but Burke and his men would find water when they needed it, and manage the crossing without too much hardship. In fact, the lack of difficulty would cause Burke and Wills to call into question the region's fearsome reputation. The truth is, Burke had been really, really lucky in two ways. The first way was because of the rains. If you recall last episode, Burke had noted that there were storm clouds to the northwest. Well, he figured that the rains would fill up the water holes in the direction the expedition was heading towards. And he was right. There had been heavy rains, and that had left more water than normally one would expect. And the second way Burke was lucky was the route he took was about as good as he was going to get. If they had gone slightly west, the VEE would have ventured into a larger desert, called the Simpson Desert, just like Charles Sturt had done 15 years before. If the expedition had gone east, water was much more scarce. Instead, the expedition threaded the needle. In the middle of the Stony Desert, they would find a creek, calling it Gray's Creek, after Charlie Gray. And then on Christmas Day, about 150 miles north of Cooper's Creek, the red and brown of the desert gave way to a green floodplain. Burke had found a branch of the Diamantina River. There was green grass, big trees, yay to shade, and lots of wildlife, including massive flocks of white cockatoos and wild turkeys. This was a massive stroke of luck for Burke. The Diamantina leads to the Georgina River system, which goes north toward the Gulf of Carpentaria. Burke did not know it at the time, but he had found a rough road map to the north, complete with water for much of the way. The VEE would be able to follow the Diamantina River for 90 miles before it veered east. Here, the expedition would leave the river and head north. So, things were going pretty good for Burke and his men. However, there were still major challenges ahead of them, the foremost being the health of the men. We need to remember that, despite having a roadway to the north, the VEE was now in an incredibly hot and arid environment, and it began to take a toll on the men. The men's skin would burn and flake off, nails would crack, cuts would fester and never heal, and then there was the sand and dust. It got everywhere. It would mix with the men's sweat and make a gritty paste, chafing the men's groins like sandpaper. And the strong and ever-present winds blew into the men's eyes and mouths, leaving them with sore eyes and scratchy throats. The dry air literally sucked the water out of the bodies of the men, and even if they found water each day, they could not replace it fast enough. They likely suffered from dehydration and salt depletion. This would have meant cramps and fatigue. In this harsh environment, the men's bodies would have slowly wasted away, and their diet did not do them any favors. They had been eating salt meat and flour for months. They were not getting enough vitamins and nutrients. Scurvy was the biggest threat. The expedition had brought lime juice along to battle that exact thing, but Burke had gotten rid of it as he did not believe that it could actually help. And the health issues were not limited to the men. It included the camels and the horse. Contrary to opinions of the time, camels were not invincible. They needed their rest and a proper diet. They were getting neither. On January 15th, 1 month into the march, the expedition was often traveling 20 and 25 miles a day, with no days off. Thus, the animals and the men were slowly losing their strength and endurance. The expedition would push north and continue to be lucky, finding isolated water holes and creeks, meaning water was not much of an issue despite the arid environment. Then, as the party moved beyond the desert, the lands improved as they crossed the Tropic of Capricorn. Here, it was greener and the wildlife more commonplace. It was especially good for the health of the horses and the camels. Burke would run into a major obstacle at this time in the form of the Selwyn Ranges, a rugged mountain range in the continent's interior. The Selwyn Ranges are a large area filled with red cliffs and peaks, crisscrossed by valleys and huge gorges. The ranges are notoriously difficult to navigate due to the high walls and slopes of loose scree, much of it nearly impossible to climb. There was no simple way through. The men had to pick a route and try to keep going north. It was a slow and tedious process, and the VEE only managed to travel 6 or 7 miles a day. Also, the members of the expedition noted that they were being watched. This would have been the Kalkadoons, one of the continent's fiercest Aboriginal tribes. To the relief of everyone, the expedition would pass through the lands unmolested. However, it would later be discovered that the Kalkadoons had wanted to attack Burke and his men. This information was discovered 20 years later, when other men passing through the area met some of the locals, who recalled the passage of Burke and the VEE and their strange animals. The locals said that many of the tribe wanted to attack and kill the interlopers, but they were frightened by the huge, roaring beasts that accompanied them. Anyhow, the expedition would finally cross the ranges on January 20th and continue to follow the rivers and creeks north. By January 27th, the men were about 170 miles from the northern coast, and this meant that the expedition had moved into what was called Gulf Country. The area south of the Gulf of Carpentaria is said to have only two seasons, dry and wet. The wet season is from December to April, and it brought a tropical climate that was oppressively hot and humid. Thus, Burke and his men had gone from the frying pan and into the steamer. It was so hot, the expedition began to rise early, like 2 o'clock in the morning early, so that they could march in the dark when it was not so stifling hot. It was around this time, with the expedition about 150 miles from the coast, that Burke and his men intersected with the east-west path that Augustus Gregory had taken on his 1856 expedition along the northern edge of Australia. In doing this, Burke could have said, "Hey, I filled in the big blank area on the map, and that's really all I said I would do. Time to go home." And if he had done that, he would have been perfectly justified in his actions. I mean, he and his men and the animals were exhausted, and the provisions were running low. And let's remember, Burke had only brought 90 days of provisions, meaning he was almost exactly halfway through his supplies. But let's be honest, we know what Robert Burke will do. He had told friends that he was going to cross Australia or die in the attempt, and he sure as heck wasn't going to stop now, not with his goal so near. Thus, the VEE would push onward. The going would be slow and steady for the next week or so, but it was not easy. One of the camels, Golaw was his name, got stuck in a creek and had to be abandoned, the supplies he carried redistributed to the other animals. And the heat was absolutely brutal. Now sweat poured out of the men. They were weak and weary and suffered from headaches and lack of sleep. Even the nights were oppressive and muggy. Also, bugs were everywhere and everything was damp. The men's clothing was slowly falling apart. The expedition would reach the Flinders River and march into increasingly swampy lands. The heavy camels would struggle in the swamps, constantly fighting from getting stuck. Also, the men had to keep an eye out for the large, aggressive crocodiles that prowled the waters. Finally, on February 9th, near the junction of what is the Bino and Flinders River, Camp 119 to the men, Burke called a halt. The expedition was about 30 miles from the coast, and the men could taste salt in the water. They were so close. However, the mangrove swamps were too difficult for the camels to pass through. They were just too big and heavy. Thus, Burke elected to split the party up again. He would proceed to the Gulf of Carpentaria along with Wills and Billy the Horse and 3 days of provisions. King and Gray would remain at Camp 119 with the camels. The next morning, the men and the horses would struggle forward, finding themselves knee-deep in water and mud. Billy would get stuck multiple times before they would finally find firmer ground, as well as trails used by the local Aboriginal people. In fact, Burke and Wills would encounter some natives who would help them by pointing out the best trails to take toward the coast. The next morning, the men would leave the horse at a safe spot, hobbling him so he would not wander too far. Burke and Wills would push on alone, but their pace would be molasses-like slow. They found themselves mired in the swamp, knee-deep in mud and muck, each step a fight. It was exhausting. And then, after covering only 15 or so miles in 2 days, Burke acknowledged the inevitable. He and Wills were done. The swamps before them were impassable. Despite being only about a dozen miles from the coast, it was time to turn around. I cannot imagine what it would have been like for the two men. Knowing what they had endured, the physical and mental suffering, it must have been absolutely heartbreaking to not walk into the ocean, or at least get a glimpse of it. But Burke would put on a good face in his notes, saying, quote, "At the conclusion of the report, it would be well to say that we reached the sea, but we could not obtain a view of the open ocean, although we made every endeavor to do so." End quote. And Burke was correct. They had reached the Gulf of Carpentaria, although the mangrove swamps had prevented them from actually seeing the ocean. The history books, for the most part, say that the expedition did cross the continent. With that, Burke and Wills would make their way back to Camp 119, collecting Billy along the way. And here, all four of the men understood that no matter what had happened with regards to their quest to reach the North Coast, they had an even more daunting task ahead of them. They had to get home. It had taken Burke and his men nearly 2 months to reach this very spot, and an inventory of supplies showed that they only had provisions for 1 month, and that was being generous. The men and animals were physically and mentally exhausted. They had lost weight. Their clothing was in tatters. Their hair and beards were long and ragged, and it was upwards of 1,000 miles to get back to the depot at Cooper's Creek. Author Sarah Murgatroyd, in her book The Dig Tree, said of this moment, quote, "The expedition was no longer a race for glory. It was a fight for survival," end quote. And that is very, very true. So that, my friends, is where we will leave Burke and Wills and John King and Charlie Gray for today. They had crossed the Australian continent, even if they had not seen the ocean. Now they had a 60-day march ahead of them and only 30 days of food. As you can imagine, it is not going to be pretty. Next time, Burke and Wills will set out for Cooper's Creek, where William Brough will wait impatiently for William Wright in the relief column to reach them. And that is where we will end everything for today. I hope you enjoyed part 5 in our series on the Burke and Wills expedition. I will see you next time. Thank you for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for the Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.